Good afternoon. It's Monday, the 19th of June, 2017, just after 1 o'clock. Welcome to UK Column News. I'm your host, Brian Gerrish. With me in the studio, of course, Mike Robinson, excuse me. We're also joined by Vanessa Beely today. Really wonderful to have Vanessa back on live after her recent travels in Syria. But we're going to kick off today with Grenfell Tower, which, of course, is an immense tragedy.
Yes, so 79 people now, it's been announced, 79 people are either dead or presumed dead. Local people disagree. I disagree, Brian, but we'll come on to that in a second.
Yes, absolutely. Well, let's come in at this angle. Here, we obviously got a picture of the tower post-fire. What's the media talking about at the moment? Well, of course, they're still very much on the cladding. And here we've got the Mail revealed how fears about cut price cladding were ignored. Manufacturers warned deathly panels should never be fitted above 32 feet, but contractors made the disturbing decision to install them anyway. Now, I'm going to say in response to that headline, it is, of course, incorrect because the final decision was not with the contractors. But while all of this discussion is going on about cladding, let's have a look at what local residents have been saying to the UK column. They say that more than 50 children are dead. They say that local schools are actually closed, and this makes it very difficult for parents and the community to actually find out what has happened with children or numbers of children who may have died. The local people are saying that they believe the total death toll is now over 300. And they believe that many, if not most, of those that have died are in fact Muslims. The authorities are still not admitting or clarifying the scale of the disaster. And on Sunday, the 18th of June, hundreds were on the streets locally, many dressed in their Sunday best in respect. But there was no media reporting, and we'll come on to that a little bit later.
Absolutely. Now, on the Sunday Wire programme with Patrick Henningsen last night on his radio programme, we discussed this website. This is the EDIS website. It is UN-approved website, and according to the United Nations, what they do is provide useful information regarding emergency situations and their prevention. Extraordinary events happening in the world are being monitored 24 hours a day. All events processed by EDIS are displayed in real time. So this is their website. There's the map, recognised by the United Nations. This is the page that covers the Grenfell stuff, the Grenfell information. So here's the event summary. And as you scroll down the page, it shows some statistics. Now, these are the statistics this morning. They're saying that 58 are dead. Obviously, the police have now raised that to 79. This hasn't been updated as yet. They're saying that there are 30 injured, that there are missing zero. There are no missing people anymore. But there were only 65 evacuated or rescued people. And total affected is 650, according to this website. Now, what was interesting was that on Saturday, if you looked at this page, the number of missing people was listed as 538. Now, as I said on the Sunday Wire programme last night, Brian, that leaves 497 people. If we assume that there are 65, and the fire brigade, the London Fire Brigade have acknowledged or have stated that they rescued 65 people. We now know the number of dead and we now know the number of injured. So that is about 460 people that we don't know the status of because there are no public announcements, Brian. So we don't know whether some of these people were outside the building at the time because they had been at prayer for Ramadan, but that would only be men. Women and children would be in the building. Were they asleep or were they awake? We don't know. Did they get out themselves? Yeah. We don't know. And as we said last night, I am not aware of any major incident like this where the authorities are trying to hide the numbers of people that are affected.
Or indeed why they would do that. So what can we say at the moment? According to the information we're getting, the authorities are simply not telling the truth. Why that is, we don't know. Saturday morning, I tweeted out that in fact, UK Column was aware on Friday that 50 people had been found dead in the stairwell. That was a very early report. We decided it wasn't right to report that. But even by Saturday morning, mainstream press and media still not telling the truth. I think the BBC was still stuck on 17 dead. We tweeted out that figure of 50. And within 2 hours, I think the Metropolitan Police were actually stating that the total number was 58.
Yeah.
And now that's subsequently increased to 79. So the question is, why would the authorities not want to tell the truth about the scale of this disaster?
Well, let's have a look at what Theresa May had to say over the weekend. She said earlier today that she met with victims of the Grenfell Tower tragedy and the volunteers and community leaders who are working so hard to help people rebuild their lives. I'm not certain that local people would agree with that statement, because I'm not certain very many of them were aware of Theresa May's presence. She said, but frankly, the support on the ground for families who needed help or basic information in the initial hours after this appalling disaster was not good enough. So, Brian, I find it very interesting, therefore, that the response for people that have been affected by this has been handed over to the British Red Cross. They are running the relief exercise.
So we have a government at the moment which is not capable of handling, I'm going to choose my words very carefully here, this is a terribly serious event, but the government ought to be able to cope with massive national, nationwide emergencies, but they can't cope with this event, so it's gone to the Red Cross.
That's absolutely right. Then getting back to what Theresa May said, I can confirm that a £5 million emergency fund that I announced yesterday is now being distributed on the ground so people can buy clothes, food and other essentials. If more funding is required, it will be provided. Now, I'm very interested in this so that people can buy food and clothes. There's food, water and clothing being donated by hundreds, if not thousands, of good British people. What's happening to that? Why is that not being distributed? Why are they giving? I mean, it's appropriate, perhaps, that money is being given out, but we'll come on to that in a second. But why is she specifically suggesting that it's for these purposes when there's so much goodwill has been offered already?
Yeah. I'm just going to live interject with this. Isn't it interesting that there's still no debate over this in Westminster? Could it be that if there was a debate in Westminster on the scale of this tragedy, that would actually change all of the government's focus and priorities at the moment? So we've got a government that apparently can't cope with this disaster. We have to use the Red Cross. And then we have the same government, as we're going to hear later in the news today, making some really dangerous decisions in other areas.
Right. So let me just explain why I mentioned that issue of the money being used to buy food and so on. And that is because we are hearing, and I'll say that this is unconfirmed at this point in time, but we are hearing that the donations that have been given by people are being sold. And so that I think would be a particularly concerning situation if it's true. And I'm hoping to speak to somebody just after the programme to get to the bottom of this allegation.
Right. Yep.
Theresa May then went on to say that her government will continue to do absolutely everything possible to help all those affected through the difficult days, weeks and months and years ahead. Well, let's just have a think about these payments that she's talking about. She's saying it's a £5 million emergency Grenfell Tower residents discretionary fund. It's going to be distributed. And what does that mean? £5,500 to each household affected by this. That's a £500 cash payment and a £5,000 payment delivered through the Department of Work and Pensions directly into people's bank accounts. Now, Brian, correct me if I'm wrong, but many of the people in this building were refugees. They don't have bank accounts. I'm quite certain they don't have bank accounts.
Well, we believe many of them didn't speak English either.
And we suspect that many of them haven't survived this event. So how many of these £5,000 payments are actually being made? She's claiming this is a £5,000 emergency fund. A £5 million emergency fund. I don't think it's anything of the kind at the end of the day. So access to the fund is apparently one element of the support being made available. And comes on top of, they say, support for the council through the Belwyn scheme, a guarantee of funding for temporary accommodation funding for legal representation for residents, and additional $1.5 million to pay for mental health support?
Yes.
Right. So what kind of mental health support do you think they're going to be getting?
I think the sort of help which is going to make matters worse. But there's a reason for saying that. We'll leave that for another day. Let's come back onto the subject of who's to blame. And not surprisingly, the press are straight on to the company that put in the cladding. Now, there is a story here because this company, Curtain Wall, Harley Curtain Wall, has a checkered history. There was clearly money being lifted.
Excuse me.
And the key directors, husband and wife team involved with this. This is a picture of their mansion. So the focus at the moment, interestingly, on the private company that provided and erected the cladding, it is not on the role of the local council, of course, a Tory council, that had the overall fire safety as part of its key responsibility. So my view here is that we're already trying to drift this away from that Tory-controlled council. The Mail here has got a picture of Raymond himself, bosses of company that installed Grenfell Tower cladding, pumped $2.5 million into the tax avoidance schemes. And so this is another article very heavy on blame for this company, but the ultimate responsibility for the installation and the fire safety with that Tory-controlled council. The leader of the council, Nick Paget, I can remember his second name, excuse me, Brown, right. Paget Brown, refuses to say whether he will resign over the Grenfell Tower fire. He says the response was effective. That's an interesting expression. He says he will cooperate with an inquiry. But when we looked into this article, we were fascinated to see this. Kensington and Chelsea councillors face criticism over its decision to build up a reserve fund of £274 million. The Shadow Community Secretary, Andrew Gwynn, told the Independent the Council needed to immediately explain itself over why the funds were not used to ensure safe housing. Now, we can say that as UK column working with the British Constitution Group, it was retired policeman John Hurst who started to warn about the massive reserve funds held by local councils all the way across UK, not just Conservative councils, but also, of course, Labour or with part control with Lib Dems, for example. So massive sums of money, but the British government has to find a measly £5 million in order to help. And we'll add this, that Mr. Paget Brown told World at One that this money was used to invest in new facilities, such as a new academy for local children. Mm. I think we know what that will be about, new leisure centres and, quote, upgraded housing. So this is an appalling situation, and the truth of it needs to come out into the public domain. Now, what can we say? Well, if you want to know how councils behave around fire safety, no better place to go than to Sheffield. And if we go back in time to 2013, here was a report in The Star about Apollo Group, who were contractors for Sheffield City Council, and they upgraded some low-rise housing blocks in Lansdowne, Leverton and Hanover Estates. And why are we interested? Well, if we get in with this, there was a lot of controversy. The costs were all put on the leaseholders. Companies were obviously making big profits. And then when the community got unhappy, Sheffield Council said work had also included digital TV upgrades for 700 homes and 200 properties receiving decent homes improvements, such as new kitchens and bathrooms.
Is this so that they can watch their televisions while all is burning around?
While Rome burns. Mm. Well, we're delighted to say we've had a lot of information through from Sheffield. And here is part of an email sent to Taylor Andrew in Sheffield City Council. This is back in 2012, warning of fire risks in the cladding system at Hanover and Lansdowne. And the response back from the council, which is the part we've put on screen, I refer to your emails of the 27th of September and 3rd of October to Building Control regarding the cladding, and response as follows. And Importantly, it's got part of the original text that the person wrote in. It goes on to state here, I can confirm we have a building regulation application for the refurbishment works being carried out of the Hanover and Lansdowne estates. The application has been checked for building regulations and compliance and conditional approval issued. But this response was a response to somebody saying they were concerned about the fire risks. And if I put this part in, which is part of the embedded text, I can't show you all of this in order to protect the source, but this is sufficient. And for your information, a lovely anecdote. When we had the fire, I had a row with the cops, the half-hour stay put policy, but I was forced to evacuate. When the police hammered on the incredible £1,000 fire protection doors, their knuckles went through a fair few doors, fact not fiction. And for your information, the cladding on the hotel in Dubai that set on fire rapidly a while back, cladding modern
stuff
was the main reason for the rapid spread. But hey, what do us plebs know? So here we see the public warning about what's there, and a very hard rebuttal from the council responsible. We did a little bit of research this morning and we came up with these questions recorded at a full council meeting for Sheffield City Council on the 3rd of October 2012. This I found astonishing. Let's bring that up so you can read it. So basically they're saying that all systems are accredited to be put on a masonry wall, not class 3 high fire risk smart ply as the wall. Is it acceptable to increase the fire risk? Is it acceptable to increase the fire risk was the public question, and the response was the wall panel has always been a timber frame construction and the addition of more timber smart ply to brace and strengthen it does not increase the fire risk. So you increase the amount of fuel for a fire, Mike, but apparently that doesn't increase any of the fire risk.
Well, clearly they know something about the laws of physics that
other people don't. Yeah. Indeed. And then we took a look at what South Yorkshire Fire and Rescue had to say. They've got a statement following Grenfell Tower fire, and they say, well, don't worry because all precautions have been put in place. Appropriate discussions have been had with local authorities. This is a question sent in to Yorkshire Fire on 2013. Has the Lansdowne Hanover estate been assessed as a greater fire risk in your services fire risk assessments since the retrofit of the cladding? And look at the reply. The fire risk assessment is completed by the designated responsible person at the premises and not South Yorkshire Fire and Rescue. So they ignore the question. They sidestep the question.
Well, no, actually, it's much worse than that, isn't it? Because what they're saying, the designated responsible person, this is the person, I guess, that works for whichever tenant management organisation is responsible for those buildings in Sheffield. And the point here, isn't it, is that this is a national problem. It's not something which is restricted to Kensington.
Indeed. This is right the way across the property portfolio. And what we're increasingly find is when residents use their common sense and raise issues of fire safety with the local authority, there is an arrogant suppression of any of their concerns. And of course, Grenfell Tower now says what the penalty of that type of put down.
So just before you move on, the question in my mind is this designated responsible person, was this designated responsible person in any way part of the decision to put this cladding on in the first place? Is there in fact any kind of separation of powers at that level?
Well, this is what is going to come out, Mike. I think we're seeing in many of these local authority housing schemes that there is no separation in the power, because basically the housing is so the local authority still has a foot in the door with the local housing, even though the immediate control of the housing has been passed on to a private company or some quasi private company. We'll end on this. This is some comments from one of the local residents in the area, and they said, for Brian, yesterday, Sunday the 19th of June, there was a complete news blackout on Grenfell Fire. What was surprising, there were hundreds of men, women and children in their Sunday best, all ages and races. The atmosphere was like Notting Hill Carnival without the carnival music. There was music that was appropriate for this sombre pilgrimage to the Grenfell Tower, brackets, tomb in the sky. What surprises me, compared to Tuesday through Saturday, when the place was teeming with mainstream media, there was not one in sight operating. I walked to the church in the area and found two non-functioning ITN news vans, no recording in progress, and they then say to me, sending two videos. They phoned LBC Radio and asked if they were receiving public views, and the resident says, I was told no in a harsh voice at about 1:30 a.m. today. So they're asking what is going on, we are asking what's going on. A lot more work to do.
I think it's clear what's going on. They're trying their best to move the news agenda on and to consign this event to history so that people aren't watching what's going on as more and more casualties are announced.
Indeed.
Yeah. So we'll bring Vanessa in at this point because, Vanessa, obviously Syria is your main issue, but the Syria campaign here trying to make political hay out of the Grenfell tragedy, and that has to be a tragedy in itself.
This is an all-time low. This is an attempt by mainstream media, not only Syria campaign, which we know to be running the PR campaign for the White Helmets and various other NGOs and organizations inside Syria, funded by Ayman Asfari, CEO of Petrofac, with interests in BP Petroleum inside Syria, so very clearly with a vested interest, political interest inside Syria, and obviously oil interests. So we see basically a Syria campaign running this message from our team in Daraa. Now, let's bear in mind that 2 weeks ago, this team in Daraa actually were caught on film cheering an extrajudicial execution of a prisoner by the extremist factions in Daraa, and were then seen once again mopping up after an extrajudicial execution. Of course, this organization funded by the British government to the tune of 65 million. So in effect, we're seeing the British government clearly funding terrorism to a huge level, while, of course, cutting back on aid for their own civilians in a domestic crisis and a human tragedy on UK soil. And again, I mean, this is a complete insult to the paramedics, to the firefighters in the UK, by conflating them with what is effectively an organization not only affiliated with Al-Qaeda, but proven now to be Al-Qaeda to a large extent, to be working side by side with Al-Qaeda, participating in and enabling atrocities against the Syrian people carried out by Al-Qaeda. This is just an extraordinary low in the media shilling for war in Syria. To use one victim from the Grenfell tragedy to name one victim, which happens to be a Syrian, and to use that story to further demonize the Syrian government without any investigation actually into the background of that particular refugee, which I'm now carrying out with the help of people inside Syria trying to actually locate his family, because there is some suspicion. The immediate use of Abdulaziz Al-Mashi as a spokesperson, who is co-founder of Syria Solidarity UK, a UK regime-supported organization fostering terrorism both in the UK and recruiting and sending terrorists into Syria. Al-Mashi's testimony depicted this family as having fled Syria to flee Assad. Where is the evidence of that? Why have the mainstream media not investigated that claim? What is Al-Mashi's relationship with these refugees, with this young man that tragically died in this fire? But why is the focus on him and not on the other 79 victims that have been made a statistic? And as you mentioned, the possible other 538 that are missing. Of course, it's because this was a precursor of the U.S. aggression in Syria that has escalated over the last 48 hours.
Okay, well, look, we'll talk about that in a bit more detail in a second, but we'll just mention that, of course, Channel 4 News, one of the main culprits on this. But look, we've got to move through a couple of other things before we come on to Syria as a main topic. I'll just remind everybody, if you haven't heard last night's Sunday Wire, please get along to 21stcenturywire.com and listen to that. We've had some commentary from local people and from people reporting from the area. So that was a fantastic program that Patrick put together.
Excellent. And we're just going to remind people that if you go to the UK Column website, you can now read that amazing letter, a harrowing letter that Melanie Shaw sent to me a few days ago. And of course, when you read the letter and see what she is describing, life inside solitary confinement inside a British prison, this is the sheer hypocrisy of Theresa May in particular, who was Home Secretary at the time Melanie went into prison. But we are putting people in solitary confinement. We are playing with their mind because they are child abuse whistleblowers who've dared to mention connections with child abuse and the British government. Same government is telling Assad and other overseas leaders how they should run their countries. It is obscene.
Absolutely. Now, of course, as I said, the news agenda, they're trying their best to move it on from the tragedy in Kensington. One of the mechanisms, one of the stories that they're using to do that is the attack in Finsbury Park. Still quite confused, I think, as to what actually happened here. Sky News reporting apparently that there were three people in the van, one person captured and the other two got away. Well, you can see on screen the person that's been arrested so far. This is what Amber Rudd had to say. My thoughts are with all those affected by the appalling incident in Finsbury Park. I'm in contact with the Metropolitan Police and confirmed that it's being investigated by the Counter-Terrorism Command. Yesterday, like so many others around the country, I took part in the great get-together to celebrate the values of Joe Cox. It was a powerful and moving to see the community come together in a show of solidarity. We must all continue to stand together, resolute against all those who try to divide us and spread hate and fear. Vanessa, this is being said by some to be a reprisal for Muslim terrorist attacks, so-called Muslim terrorist attacks recently. What have you heard about this so far?
Well, interestingly, we just had a report in from eyewitnesses that was published on Facebook literally just before I came on the program. Just taking out some of the main points from that. Eyewitnesses claim that the van came through a bus lane and took a left turn and mowed down worshippers. In other words, what they're saying, this was a pre-planned, deliberate and premeditated attack. 7 to 8 people were injured and 1 confirmed dead. Now, this is interesting. Police did not arrive immediately. And when they did, around 45 minutes later, which was confirmed by eyewitnesses holding down the attacker, they did so in normal clothing. No armed police, as you would expect in response to an attack of this magnitude, as we had seen in London. The ambulance also did not arrive until after 45 minutes. And according to eyewitness reports, drove straight past 6 injured victims without stopping. There was no media presence until around 3 hours after the attack. And the media did not report the attacks as breaking news or with any seriousness until at least more than 2 hours after it had happened. So, I mean, we're seeing sort of an extraordinary difference in response to this attack by what we assume from the description of a white male attacker on Muslim worshippers leaving the mosque compared to, of course, a Muslim attack on Londoners a week or 10 days ago. So, you know, are we seeing a divide and conquer policy going on here? Are these isolated attacks? Are they genuinely reactionary attacks against what is perceived to be happening in the UK? It's very difficult to tell. As I said, this is very, very fresh information that's coming in now.
Okay, thank you for that. We will keep a look on, at that and keep people posted on that in the coming days. Now, defence news, and the Canadian Armed Forces, Brian, have taken over the Queen's Guard at Buckingham Palace. This is the first time in history that this has happened. It's happening in conjunction with a new Canadian defence policy, apparently. So this is the 2nd Battalion Princess Patricia's Canadian Light Infantry, and they took over the Queen's Guard for the first time. And the role will involve 85 soldiers from the unit, as well as musicians who are based at Garrison Edmonton, Alberta. The Canadian troops will be instantly recognisable by their distinctive hats, apparently. Right. So there you go. What do you make of that?
I'd like to know who made the decision, because I think this is a constitutional issue. Who made the decision? When was it discussed? What notes were taken? Why weren't the public informed? And I think that this is possibly because we've now got to a stage where the British Army is so desperately short of men that they're going to need all of these ancillary roles actually place quite a strain. So Canadians coming in because something is going to happen that's going to involve the meat of the British Army, possibly.
Yeah, so some planned
some event or fighting overseas,
yes.
Or the fact that we're seeing this, I'm going to use the term, wicked Conservative government ramping up the violence in the Middle East. So are we about to put those boots on the ground that David Cameron said would never happen?
The other thing that everybody says would never happen, of course, is EU military unification. And over the weekend, Michael Fallon was speaking with his Dutch counterpart. They have apparently created a British-Dutch defence pact, just another one. So we've got now Britain and France together. We've now got Britain and the Netherlands together. We've got the Netherlands and Germany together. We've got Germany and Romania together, Germany and France together. So this is all shipping up quite nicely, but we're not unifying the EU's military.
Well, this is all lies, lies and lies, isn't it, by Mr. Fallon, Theresa May and the rest of the Conservative government. And, of course, now we've got this carrying on under the horrific events in Grenfell Tower. So people distracted at the moment. There's an air of confusion coming in the country. Remember that those Tory MPs were talking about the Tories introducing chaotic changes in the public sector. We've got all that happening. And then what's happening? Our military is being locked into this EU unified military system. And it's happening very quickly.
Right. So if we just put these two back up, on the left is Michael Fallon. He said today the UK has stepped up its relationship with the Netherlands, one of our closest and reliable European allies. We've committed to working more closely. The UK is stepping forward and not back from the global stage and will continue to defend our continent before and after Brexit. The UK and the Netherlands have a long history working together through the UN-NATO Joint Expeditionary Force. And more recently, the Counter-Daesh Global Coalition. The Dutch have also committed a company of Marines to the UK, led NATO Very High Readiness Joint Task Force. Right. And Janine Hennis-Plessard, who is the Minister of Defence for the Netherlands, Alex Thompson, I'm sure, will criticise me for my pronunciation, but she said that she very much values the strong military ties between the UK and the Netherlands. She said, we need each other more than ever, military cooperation, either bilateral or within NATO-EU. And this is the first time I've seen this phrase, NATO-EU. This is an acknowledgement of the intention to merge NATO and the EU, or form some kind of very close defence pact between NATO and the EU, bearing in mind that quite a number of NATO member states are EU member states. What this indicates is a new formal unified institution called the EU military.
Yeah, and we're being buried deep inside it. And of course, once that's happened, we won't see our armed forces again. So if there was to be any form of civil unrest in Britain, my prediction is you will see the government trying to bring in overseas forces, of which the French would be number one candidate. Mm-hmm. So just watch out. Anybody talking about helping to create violence on the streets, this is so dangerous, because what we can expect to see are European police brought in, French police, of course, are military, they're not civilian police, or we're actually going to see EU armed forces brought in to help control the situation.
Glynis Brown in the chat box has made the comment that NATO EU will sideline the UK. I'm going to say that's not the case because it's the UK that's driving this.
City of London, perhaps we should say.
Well, for sure.
Yes.
Yes. Anyway, then David Davis, possibly the next Prime Minister, is heading to, well, it has head over to Brussels to open apparently official talks. This is the other big talking point, which is pushing Grenfell Tower off the news agenda. We're not going to cover this today, other than to say that he said that as he heads to Brussels to open official talks, there should be no doubt we are leaving the European Union and delivering on that historic referendum result.
Which I believe is a lie.
Yes, so do I. And just before we get on to Syria then, it has been announced that we are looking at a two-year parliament, which the Queen's speech, of course, on Wednesday this week, parliament will sit for 2 years instead of the usual one, to give MPs enough time to fully consider the laws required to make Britain ready for Brexit, apparently. There you go. They're describing it as a rare two-year parliamentary session. It's going to double the length of the normal parliamentary session, and the Great Repeal Bill is the key piece of legislation which they're going to discuss. And let's remember that the Great Repeal Bill is not about repealing any legislation, quite the opposite in typical parliamentary
double speak.
The Great Repeal Bill is about formalising European legislation as domestic law. It repeals nothing. Andrea Leadsom said the UK will spend the next 2 years preparing for our departure from the European Union. And how she said it with a straight face, I've no, well, clearly on screen there we can see she doesn't have one, but there you go. Right, let's discuss some good news here, because Vanessa, last week you were in the United Nations in Geneva. Just tell us, the event that you were at was a Russian organised event discussing the rebuilding of Aleppo, is that right?
Yeah, that's right. I mean, it was actually a fascinating event. It was organised by the Russian mission in the UN in Geneva. And myself and Marinella Coraggio, an Italian activist, were asked to participate and to speak for myself on the media mass deception concerning Aleppo for the 5 years of the terrorist occupation of East Aleppo. And Marinella was speaking more on a humanitarian basis, particularly about the children that have been injured by the various terrorist attacks from East Aleppo into West Aleppo. What was absolutely fascinating about this entire event was the level of knowledge and experience that came from the Russian participants, particularly the military high command that were there, including the general that had overall responsibility for Russian operations inside Aleppo. The fact that they could produce statistics on the humanitarian aid that they had provided under the umbrella of Syrian institutions, but with Russian help inside Aleppo, that, of course, I witnessed myself in December during the liberation when I was allowed into some of the Russian mobile field hospitals. But also talking about the loss of life for the Russian humanitarians, for the doctors, for the helicopter pilots who were offering and providing humanitarian aid and medical aid for the civilians of Aleppo. What was also very interesting, we were being filmed and live streamed by various media channels, but including Associated Press, who at the end of this very detailed, very informed presentation by the Russian mission asked two questions. The first was regarding the number of Christians that had returned to Aleppo. Why had we not mentioned the Sunni Muslims returning to Aleppo? So again, furthering the sectarian narrative, in reality, very few Sunnis had left Aleppo because, of course, in reality, they would not be under threat from the extremist factions to the same extent as the minority factions, such as the Shia Muslims or the Christians. The Christian communities in Aleppo having reduced by about 50% during the terrorist siege, of course. And then he had asked how the Russians could justify talking about humanitarian aid when, of course, they were responsible for the destruction of Aleppo. I mean, I have to smile slightly because the determination of the mainstream media, despite having been outed and exposed for their shilling for war, for their maintaining of the terrorist siege of East Aleppo by giving platform to Al-Qaeda-affiliated activists and citizen journalists during the entire 5 years, the fact that they can try and maintain their narrative despite the exposure of their criminality in their reporting and misrepresentation of the facts on the ground in Syria, but predominantly in Aleppo, was extraordinary.
Well, that was a pretty positive event. What do you think is going to come out of that?
I think what came out of it, I mean, for me, something that was really quite a dramatic and inspirational effect of this was not so much during the conference itself, but afterwards in the reception, when I heard very personal views from the military high command, the Russian military high command, that from their perspective, they were defending the right and the freedom of the Syrian people to self-determination. In other words, to determine the culture that they live in, rather than have it imposed upon them by external hostile forces, predominantly NATO and Gulf states and Israel. And so there was a very clear admiration for the Syrian people, for their resistance against the US coalition hegemony and desire for supremacy in the region. So that was a very interesting factor. It was a very interesting factor to really get a grasp of the extent to which the Russian military, in particular, on the ground in Syria, is working not as a, you know, as they're portrayed sometimes as an occupying force, but as a comradely, allying force with the Syrian army, fully respecting of the Syrian Arab army's defense of its homeland and its territorial integrity.
Yeah. In the last 24, 48 hours, things aren't going so well, of course. The US have now, I understand, admitted that they shot down a Syrian army aircraft in southern Raqqa. Then we had reports of Iran firing a missile against terrorist bases in eastern Syria in retaliation for the Tehran attacks. And we had news of China getting involved in joint naval drills with Russia in the area. And then most recently, news that the pilot from that downed aircraft still hadn't been found, and there was intense fighting breaking out between the Syrian army and US-backed forces in order to try to capture that, or in one case capture, but recover the pilot. So, what are your thoughts on what's been going on over the last day or so?
Well, I mean, yes, in the Military Times, it was admitted that it was a Navy FA-18E Super Hornet shot down a Syrian Su-22 on Sunday, giving the US military its first air-to-air kill since 1999. What we're seeing at the moment is an extraordinary battle going on to prevent what is effectively, of course, the partitioning of Syria by the United States and its Kurdish proxies. I have to be very clear here. The majority of Kurds inside Syria do support the Syrian state and the Syrian army in defending Syria against externally imposed terrorism. However, there are Kurdish factions who have basically sold out to the United States, to Israel, and now we see an approachment with Saudi Arabia.
So, here we've got the Times of Israel, saying after declaring autonomy, Syrian Kurds open ties with Israel. Are you saying that this is a small faction then within the Kurdish community?
It's a relatively small faction. I would still say that the majority of Kurds in Syria would still support the Syrian government. That report, actually, of the Times of Israel is from March 2016, but it's interesting in the sense that it makes it very clear that Israel is working with the Kurdish factions, not only in Syria, but in Iraq also. And obviously, the Israeli and Saudi interests here are eventually the destabilization not only of Arab unity, but of course of Iran. Saudi Arabia is making approaches towards the Kurdish factions in Iran, again, we assume, to drive a sectarian wedge into Iranian culture and communities in the same way that the Kurds have been used to drive a wedge and to force partitioning and federation, the Northern Democratic Federation in Syria. What we've actually seen, though, and this is very important, I think we're seeing a sort of a muscle flexing exercise from Syria and its allies here. We saw the Chinese and Russian joint naval exercises. We saw Iran firing mid-range missiles into Deir ez-Zor. This is very interesting because Deir ez-Zor is crucial here. The United States has formed garrisons at Al Tanf too now. They've brought in the HIMARS missile system on the ground, which has range that could basically ensure it could hit Deir ez-Zor. And we've seen the Syrian Arab Army advancing to cut off the U.S. forces from being able to join with the U.S. proxies, the YPG, to the north. And basically now the race is on for Deir ez-Zor to try and prevent this unification of a buffer zone in Al Tanf, so with the Iraqi border, joining with the U.S.-controlled Kurdish factions in Raqqa. We know that Raqqa has been undergoing an ethnic cleansing program for months now. Over 50% of the Syrian Arab population has been driven out, and the Kurds have been brought in. We've seen an escalation of the American bombing, the U.S. coalition bombing of that area, with the mass killing of civilians. We've seen the suspected use of white phosphorus, the United States claiming they're using it as a smokescreen to allow the YPG, the SDF forces, to take ground in Raqqa. We've seen collusion between the SDF and ISIS. Russian military high command stated that in June, basically, the Kurdish forces opened the back door for ISIS in Raqqa to head for Palmyra. And we know that there is collusion between the United States and ISIS. We've seen it in Deir ez-Zor. We've seen it over Palmyra. We've seen it on many, many occasions. So basically, this is an attempt by the United States and its allies in the region to ensure a buffer zone from the north around to the east and down to the south, where, of course, Israeli have southern territory, to create not only partitioning, but to narrow Syria down to a peninsula in the center that is controlled by the Syrian government. Yeah. But what we're seeing, I think, with Iran targeting Deir ez-Zor, I think we're seeing the allies of Syria saying this is not going to happen.
Okay, Vanessa, thank you very much for that. I think we'll have to leave it there for now.
We will. Lots of things to think about. Of course, we're going to stick on the point at the moment. What sort of government have we got acting in UK? We're told 1 week that they're not fully formed as a government. The next minute, we're hearing that they're going to be in post for two years. We are putting troops on the ground overseas. This is not being debated in Westminster. The government can't cope with a major incident, Grenville fire. Who is actually running the country at the moment? And I think it's beginning to become quite clear that we have a cabal. That's cross-party, so it's no good pointing a finger just at the Conservatives. This is a cross-party cabal. And these people are now out of control, I think, is fairly close to it. So watch out for anyone at the moment trying to incite violence in UK, because if we go down this path, then, of course, all of the sanctions can be brought in with curfews and shut down. What we've got to do is it's got to be a mass peaceful resistance to expose the people who are running the country at the moment. And I'll just say we will have more information on Grenville Tower tomorrow. We should have some more detailed reports by local community people, and we're going to stay on the case. Why is the British government not telling the truth about this horrific incident? That's it for today. Vanessa, thanks very much. Thank you to our viewers and listeners. We will be back at the same time tomorrow. Bye-bye. Bye-bye.